Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Ray DeMonaco, the Director of Education Policy at the Manhattan Institute, joins us to discuss whether New York should abolish the Regents exam as a graduation requirement. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study investigating the trends of parental involvement in their children's education over the past 2.5 decades. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
This all strikes me as good news. I can't help seeing the lead lining to this white puffy cloud.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, Ray DeMonaco. Ray, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Mike.
Yeah, Ray is the Director of Education Policy at the Manhattan Institute, and we're going to talk about a great piece he had recently in education next on the subject of exit and end-of-course exams. First, let me welcome my regular co-host, David Griffith. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to see you. We are taping this on Monday, I should say, before the game of the year, the game of the century, the game when Michigan has a chance to win the national championship. And of course, by the time we air this, I don't know, either we'll have won or not. So that's all I'll say about it. I promise, David. See, Ray, David's one of these guys that has opted out of the traditional American love of football in favor of that crazy European sport, soccer.
I also have the audacity to not be from Michigan, Mike. So,
well, yes, that's true. But, you know, I'm not from Michigan. I grew up in St. Louis. I just went to the best university in the country. All right. Enough of that. Ray, I really appreciate you being on the show. You wrote a piece on a topic we have been talking about here on the show some. And I've been wrestling with this idea of whether we should keep going with these exit exams and end of course exams that were put in place in many cases in the 2000s, 2010s. We see more and more states rolling back and going in the other direction. New York is having a debate about that right now. And you wrote a piece for Education Next saying that you weren't so upset if they stopped requiring everybody to pass the Regents exams. Let's talk about that on Ed Reform Update. All right, Ray, I know from your writings that you are a guy that cares a lot about excellence and high standards. And many of us with those views, we worry about grade inflation. We worry that if you don't have external measures of student achievement, that schools are going to be even lower performing than they already are. So help us understand, how can you look at the changes being debated for the Regents exams and think that they are going to be okay?
Yeah, so my perspective on this is really drawn by the New York experience, which is very unique in the country, as you well know. Long before other states adopted exit exams, going back over 100 years, New York State has always had these Regents exams. When I was a high school student in the early 1970s, they were still in full force. You had to pass a whole sequence over your 4 years of high school of rigorous exams to earn what was called a Regents endorsed diploma. What was reflected in that period and for most of the 20th century was that the Regents exams were designed for students who were deemed to be on the college prep track. More than 20 years ago, the state began this experiment, I would call it, in requiring all students to pass at least 5 Regents exams over their 4-year high school period, essentially math, science, English, history, and a foreign language, in order to gain any high school diploma. The transition from designing and applying these tests only to a select group of students, those who would deem college prep, to a universal, I believe it's been demonstrated that over the past 20 years has led to a diminution of the rigor of these exams. So really, my critique was directed at people who were arguing that what the Regents are intending to do will diminish standards. I argue that standards have been diminished over the last 20 years because there's sort of a political economy to these exit exams. The traffic will only bear so much failure, I'm afraid to say. And in order to get to what they politically deem are acceptable levels of pass rates or not having too many students fail, I believe that they have diminished the value of these tests over 20 years.
Yeah. And I think that makes a really important point. I would also add that, 20 years ago, that was probably around the height of the movement that I think we look back and say it was the college for all movement, right? We maybe weren't explicit about it, but we certainly were worried that if there were if there was such a thing as a college prep track and another track, whether it was career tech or anything else, that those tracks would be racist or classist, and that the way to raise standards across the board, to raise achievement across the board, and sort of No Child Left Behind style, was for everybody to face the same standards. But as you say, that meant lower standards than before. But, isn't it possible, Ray, that we could walk and chew gum here or have both and? Like, why not have a level on the Regents that denotes, significant college readiness, kind of the old Regents style, and a lower standard that says, hey, this is good enough for high school diploma? Could you use it for both?
I certainly believe that we can do more than one thing at once. I think the problem with using the same exam is that for all students is that it almost invites manipulation to accommodate those students who are really not on the college prep track. It gets into the guts of the exam. How difficult are the questions? What are the pass rates? Just as an example, in the most current year, 2023, now, a couple of years after COVID, when they suspended or greatly reduced the need for students to take these exams, they allowed any student who got a 50% mark to appeal, their grade on the exam. And so teachers and principals and whatnot go back and they do what's called scrubbing the exam. They look at the essay questions. They look at the long form mathematical questions. Can we find an extra point to get this kid over the hump? The way I would do it would be to restore the content of the Regents exams to their former rigor and require a completion of the whole sequence to earn a Regents diploma. And then I would also, the other critique I have of New York State and the Board of Regents, our Board of Education, is that they've been slower than other states, I believe, to adopt college readiness certificates. And I think they should really work preparation certificate, preparation for the workforce. So I think they need to amp up that effort. We know from our data over many years that by the time kids are in eighth grade getting ready to enter high school, we know with a fair amount of certainty which of them are going to succeed and which are not going to reach the level of college preparedness. And in New York City, we have a robust choice system at high school. Schools align top to bottom on the achievement of their kids as they enter high school. And at the other end, the outcomes reflect that. So I would restore the rigor to the Regents, the whole sequence, label that a Regents exam. A local exam, I think, can either connote that the student has taken and passed certificate programs aligned with industry, industry standards for entry-level jobs in certain careers and workforces. And then perhaps even a local diploma could indicate that the students have passed all of their classes and I think it's important to emphasize attendance, because in the rest of the country and in New York, high school attendance is really in the cellar these days. It hasn't rebounded from COVID, and we shouldn't be letting kids graduate with 50% attendance. So, I'm not so sure about that last one, but I think we can have different levels. The Regents are saying, by the way, that it's going to be one diploma and they will allow sort of a certification or a medallion on the diploma to indicate different levels. I think they need to be more explicit about the differences.
What do you think, David? I mean, this would certainly mean that for a bunch of kids, we don't have these kinds of ends of course exams or graduation exams to make sure that the grades they're getting, the courses they're passing are meaningful.
Well, I think my first comment, Mike, is that it's probably a mistake to conflate graduation exams and end of course exams. I mean, we think of them as sort of serving similar purposes, but high schoolers are just unbelievably myopic, right? And I think many of them can grasp that there will be an exam at the end of the course, right? But they may not be similarly incentivized to put their best foot forward. If you tell them at the start of ninth grade that they'll have to pass, an exam at the end of 12th grade if they want a diploma. I'm not sure that has a lot of meaning to the average ninth grader. And I guess where I'm going with that is I'm always struggling a little bit when it comes to this conversation to understand what we're trying to accomplish, right? If we're trying to signal things to employers, I think employers have other ways of figuring these things out. I tend to share Ray's view of, you know, sort of singular graduation standards are inevitably subject to political pressure, right? You know, as soon as you create one, it will be watered down. Politicians won't tolerate 50% graduation rates or 60% or 70%. And so I guess I'm just a realist about this, right? We can have a rigorous exam that most kids won't pass, or we can have a less rigorous exam that Mike Petrilli won't be satisfied with, or Ray or whoever. But I think my personal view is that we shouldn't put too much emphasis on which of those routes we go. I think we just need to pick one and stick with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Ray, to hear the story of the New York Regents compared to, say, the Advanced Placement Program, you know, where they have maintained the standard, but now they're getting all this pushback, including a recent New York Times article that we talked about and I wrote about, you know, where people are up in arms that so many kids, especially low-income kids and Black and Latino kids, are failing the AP exams when they take them. You know, and so again, it's the trade-off. Well, in a world where we've got a big achievement gap and we've got a lot of kids coming into high school, you know, 1, 2, 3 grade levels behind, you maintain a high standard, you know, you're going to see those kinds of results on the exam. Now, you know, that's just for getting college credit. That's different than, as than graduating from high school. And as you say, the political pressure to keep to lower that bar is fierce.
Yeah, and I think there is something here that's not very easy to reconcile, and that is the movement towards higher standards, whether it was the Regents or, as you mentioned, the AP exams. Under the previous mayor in New York, de Blasio, they had a program called AP for All. They wanted to expand, you know, that all kids in high school should take some AP exams. I have no doubt that there are some lower income kids, kids from difficult backgrounds who begin high school behind, who kind of respond to the incentive. But I think those are at the margins. So there is a chance that if the state were to do what I'm suggesting, that, you know, that incentive would not be there for those kids. But I think over a long period of time, we've seen that, you know, there were not enough of those kids. It wasn't pushing, just merely incentivizing performance was not pushing enough kids over the bar. And so, again, I'd like to see different tracks. I'm in favor of that. And in each track, there should be measurement outside of the school to indicate whether the kid has achieved some standard.
Yeah. And to make sure that those tracks are leading somewhere, right? And that they're high quality.
Exactly.
All right. Well, hey, we'll need to leave it there. Ray DeMonaco of the Manhattan Institute, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, I've promised not to talk any more about Michigan football, but we can talk about the Golden Globes.
Well, you know, I watched that.
Did you? Did you? Oh, good. Tell us.
Well, you know, Mike, I watch for the women's dresses, which I don't think you probably watch for that reason. But a lot of us ladies do like to see the fashion in Hollywood. So and there was some crazy fashion as usual. There was quite some crazy fashion. But hey, I was kind of bummed. I don't know if you saw Maestro, you know, the big Brad. What's his name? Oh, man, I'm going to blank on
Bradley Cooper.
There you go, Bradley Cooper. I thought he did a phenomenal job.
That guy, not that we're in an ivory tower, but
Leonard Bernstein. But anyway, it didn't make the cut. But Oppenheimer was the big winner.
I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet. I did see Barbie. We did not do Barbieheimer. So now I've got to go back and see Oppenheimer. I've been waiting for it to be free or close to it on one of the million streaming services I already pay for.
Yes, it was good. But in my opinion, not Maestro good, but okay. I'll let you be the judge of that.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, you know what else is good? Education research, at least sometimes. So there's your segue.
All right. We're starting off a little gently, I think, in 2024. This is a descriptive study. Now, I didn't see any big, huge blockbusters this week, but I thought this was interesting. I don't cover parental involvement very much at all. But this is a trend study over time looking at parental involvement and the patterns that we see in parental involvement. For some context, you know, I mean, most studies have shown collectively that parents have increased the amount of time per week that they spend with their children. about 6 hours between the late 70s and 2005. So that's just time spent doing whatever. The current study looks at involvement over time from 1996 to 2019, right up to the pandemic. They use the National Household Education Survey, or NHES, focuses on three aspects of school involvement. So this isn't like how much you spend on school activities at home. It literally is, you know, at the school building. So they're looking at attendance in general school meetings. So this is like the open house or the back to school nights. They look at PTA or PTO meeting attendance in particular, because they can look at that separately. They look at parents participating in fundraising in their child's school, and they look at volunteering in the child's school and the frequency of those various forms of participation. And then they look at differences by high and low income families. They didn't look at, which I thought was very odd, they didn't look at levels like elementary versus middle versus high school, just income. And they're looking at the 90th and 10th percentiles in income. They're not controlling for any other characteristics that may co-vary, like race and parental education and so on. So it's just what I've said. It's not anything fancy. The NHES is repeated every 3 years. So they have 7 time points included in the study, again, from 1996 to 2019. Final sample, 93,000 roughly parent respondents or other adults in the home was how the question was worded. And they had to have a child in public school. Overall results. The proportion of parents who attended a general school meeting, like a back-to-school night kind of thing, or open house, that's incidentally the most common way that parents spend their time at their child's school, significantly increased over time. 76% said they went to those things in 1996. 85% say they went to them in 2019. In terms of PTA meetings in particular, that was stable. About 50% of parents say they go to those things. Share of parents who reported volunteering at their child's school also increased a bit over time, 36 to 38%. And the proportion of parents overall who reported fundraising for their child's school decreased, 60% to 54%. And then they look at the high versus low income parents, and they saw a mix. So some stable patterns, some not so stable. One gap, which narrowed significantly, was attendance at open meetings, general meetings. Both sets of parents at the 90th and 10th percentiles were more likely to attend those meetings over time, but low-income parents were significantly more likely to report attendance by 2019. So they were, you know, kind of gaining ground, so to speak, on the high-income parents. Overall, half of high-income parents reported volunteering at their child's school. One quarter of low-income parents said likewise, and that remained stable over time. When they looked at the number of events total that low-income parents reported attending, that number rose. Again, that narrowed the gap with the high-income parents who reported attending events less frequently over time, and low-income parents began attending them at the same rate. And then attendance at PTA meetings in particular showed also some slight convergence between the low and the high-income parents. One area that stood out the most was income-based differences in time spent fundraising for their child's school. That gap grew significantly. In each year, about three-quarters of high-income parents say they fundraised for their child's school, compared to less than half of low-income parents, and that was a significant difference in each year. The income-based gaps have grown significantly. For example, the 90-10 income gap in 2003 was 22 percentage points, which grew to 30 percentage points in 2019. So it's a larger growth even over a shorter amount of time. This pattern was driven by the decrease in the proportion of lower-income parents fundraising over time, 47 to 39%. Whereas the likelihood that high-income parents report fundraising for their school was stable from 2003 to 2019, 70%. I mean, it makes you wonder, really? 70% of high-income parents are saying they're fundraising for their kids' school. I don't know. I felt like there was some reason for optimism there, but also some things that sounded a little suspicious, but curious to see what you guys make of it.
Well, no, that all track from my perspective, I mean, again, I may be living in a bubble.
I mean, are you fundraising for your kid's school, Mike? What are you doing?
Oh my gosh, all
the
time.
You're not selling lemonade.
All the time. But here's the thing is, how do you define it? Yeah, I'm fundraising by filling out, you know, a credit card form online several times a year and donating money. I mean, now by 2019, yeah, that's probably starting to happen pretty often, right? I mean, it's, so does that count as fundraising? I mean, let me just say it this way. In my kids' schools, public schools, yes, there are many appeals for donating to various funds, the PTA, the foundation, the sports booster club, the, you know, the wrestling team fund, the football team fund, all of which is voluntary, but, you know, expected. And so, I don't know, the minute I spend filling out the credit card form and forking over some money, does that count?
I'm pretty sure it would, yes.
Probably would count. Now the other question is, you know, as they go forward with this survey, I wonder how they're going to start handling some of the, you know, online participation, right? Because there has, of course, during the pandemic, all of this stuff went online. My experience is that some of it has gone back to in-person, like the PTA meetings, maybe with the Zoom option. But then there's also, like, you know, speakers talking about things that would be useful to parents that might be online. So, you know, I wonder, they'll need to capture that as well. Hey, I'm glad we're not asking low-income parents to fundraise. I mean, thank goodness. They've got better things to do with their time.
Yeah. Listen, if we're gonna have unequal funding, I would rather that we solicit rich parents directly, right? I mean, am I being too cynical here, guys? But it almost feels, my gut reaction was, well, yeah, because we've increasingly equalized public funding, right? So if you want your school to have the nicest tennis courts in the city, you have to go to parents for it now, right? Because the other schools also have decent tennis courts. I mean, I'm exaggerating slightly, but like, I don't know. I kind of wonder, right? Like, how much of this is just a reaction at some level to the notion that our school isn't nicer anymore. And it needs to be, or else why did we send our kids here?
Yep. Hey, look, Montgomery County, Maryland, very progressive funding, as we found in an analysis a few years ago at Fordham that we did of DC area spending. And look, you know, my kid's school in the, you know, most expensive part of Montgomery County looks kind of schlubby. And you go to some of these other schools in high poverty areas and the facilities are beautiful and as it should be, right? We would say that's fine. But yes, parents say, well, all right, let's pitch in some money to try to make it a little less schlubby.
I do really like the finding about parents showing up to back to school night or parents night. I mean, poor kids, that strikes me as unambiguously good. In fact, this all strikes me as good news. I can't help seeing the lead lining to this white puffy cloud, right?
Well, I do wonder after the pandemic if we're going to see big declines. I mean, nobody shows up for anything anymore in person, right? It's just really hard to get people to leave their house.
We managed, you know, there was some requirement, right? Requirement that we volunteer at our preschool, and we managed to skirt the whole thing because of COVID, right? We had this great excuse, right, for not showing up in person. Like anyone had the time, right? I mean, with two full-time jobs and whatever, right? But I agree, Mike. I mean, I don't know. Something is lost and something is gained when you make all of this in some ways too easy, right, to do online. So I don't know. We need some pointless bake sales that don't raise any money.
But I mean, how long have we been, you know, sort of lamenting about the state of parental involvement in education, you know? And it's like, okay, how much do we really care about it? I don't know.
All right. Good stuff, Amber. But come on. Yeah. You know, no more warming up. Let's bring a hardcore empirical study next week.
You sent it to me, Mike. I couldn't not find it this week. I'm telling you, people were easing into the new year.
All right. Fair enough. Okay, guys. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off and saying go blue.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.